Despite her reserve and discretion, she had a dry but lively sense of humor and treated me to her sharp, sidelong observations on our daily life in B-dorm.
You in the ghetto now, Bunky?
Ginger Solomon, her best friend, who was also Jamaican, was like the yang to Natalie's yin. Antic, combustible, and loud. Miss Solomon was also a fantastic cook. And once she and Natalie had decided that I was all right, she would make me a plate of her special Saturday night dinner, usually a knockout curry prepared with kitchen contraband. On special occasions, Natalie would magically make roti appear. Extracurricular prison cooking happened primarily in two communal microwaves that were placed in kitchenette areas between the dorms. Their use was a privilege the staff constantly and with great enjoyment threatened to revoke. Remarkable concoctions came out of those microwaves, especially from homesick Spanish and West Indian women. This impressed me deeply, given the limited resources these cooks were working with. Junk food and polybagged chicken, packets of mackerel and tuna, and whatever fresh vegetable one could steal from the kitchen. Corn chips could be reconstituted into mash with water and transformed into delectable chilaquiles, my new prison favorite. Contraband onions were at a particular premium, and the chefs had to keep an eye peeled for guards with quivering nostrils. No matter what they were cooking, it smelled like food prepared with love and care. Unfortunately, Miss Solomon only cooked on Saturdays. I had lost 10 pounds in a month, thanks to the prison diet, all the liver, lima beans, and iceberg lettuce you want. The day I walked into prison, I looked all of my 34 years, if not worse. In the months before my surrender, I'd drowned my sorrows in wine and New York comfort food. Now my greatest comforts were time alone on the icy track and lifting weights in the gym. It was the only place in the camp where freedom and control seemed in my grasp. One of the good things about living in B-dorm was that you had your choice of two bathrooms. Both were equipped with 6 showers, 5 sinks, and 6 toilet stalls. That's where their similarities ended. Natalie and I lived next to the bathroom that I like to call the Hell Mouth. The tiles and formica were various shades of gray. The shower curtain rods were rusted. The plastic shower curtains were practically in ribbons, and not all of the stall door locks worked. None of this was what made the C-dorm bathroom a hellmouth, though. It was the infestations that made the place unacceptable for anything but a quick pee or toothbrushing. During the warmer months, when the ground was not frozen, little black maggots would periodically appear in the shower area, squirming on the tiles. Nothing could make them disappear, although the bathroom orderlies did not have much of an arsenal. The cleaning supplies were stingily doled out. Eventually, the maggots would hatch into evil little flies. They were the sign that the bathroom had been built over a direct route to hell. I showered instead in the bathroom on the other side of B-dorm, which connected to A-dorm. It was spa-like by comparison, and had been recently refurbished in shades of beige. The fixtures were new, the light was better, the mood was brighter, even if the shower curtains were just as ratty. Showers were a complex ritual. It was necessary to schlep all your hygiene products to the bathroom, shampoo, soap, razor, washcloth, and whatever else you might need. This required either great minimalism or some sort of shower caddy. Some women had illegal crocheted bags to carry their stuff. Some had mesh nylon bags from commissary, and one woman had a large pink plastic shower caddy, an actual shower caddy. I wasn't about to ask, knowing that it had either come from some long-ago and distant commissary or was contraband. Morning and evening were peak shower hours, with gradually diminishing stores of hot water. If you showered in the afternoon or early evening, you would have less competition. We were not supposed to be in the showers after lights out at 10 p.m., to discourage people from having sex in them. Many women would wait in line 3 deep for their shower to be free. In the good bathroom, there was one shower stall that indisputably had the best water pressure. Some big shots, like Pop, would send an emissary to see if that stall was free, or else dibs them a place in the waiting line. If you interfered with one of the early morning risers' shower ritual by getting into their shower, you would be met with an icy stare when you emerged. Once you had secured your shower stall, you faced a moment of truth. Some women would disappear behind the stall's plastic curtain, still fully clad in their muumuus out of modesty. Others would whip off their clothes in front of everyone and climb in and out unabashed. A handful would shower with the curtain open, giving everyone a show. At first, I was among the former, but the water was always freezing initially, and I would yelp as it rained down on my naked skin. "What's going on in there, Kerman?" someone would inevitably joke. "Piper's getting busy." After a while, I became convinced that the Linda Blair rape scene in Born Innocent was never going to be recreated in the camp. So I took to starting my shower before I got in, checking to see that it was at least lukewarm before I whipped off my muumuu and jumped in. This won me a couple of fans, notably my new neighbor Delicious, who shouted with surprise, "P.I. Piper, you got some nice titties. You got those TV titties. They stand up on their own all perky and everything. Damn." Thanks, Delicious. There was absolutely nothing threatening about Delicious's attention. In fact, it was mildly flattering that she noticed me at all. All cleaning in the camp was highly ritualized, including the all-hands-on-deck Sunday night scrub-down of our cubicles. One day a week, B-Dorm's laundry was done for us. Laundress was a prison job, captained by an elderly woman everyone called Grandma. And so the night before, I'd stuff my bag with sweat socks and a packet of laundry soap. Natalie would wake me at 5:15 before the laundry opened so that I could get mine in before everyone else. Otherwise, I'd have been part of the usual stampede of half-asleep women in the still dark hallway, getting in line to drop off their laundry bags. Why the urgency? Unclear. Did I need my laundry back in the early afternoon, as opposed to the evening? No. I found myself participating in the meaningless rituals of avoiding the laundry rush, because prison is all about waiting in line. For many women, I realized, this was nothing new. If you had the misfortune of having the government intimately involved with your life, whether via public housing or Medicaid or food stamps, then you'd probably already spent an insane amount of your life in line. I had twice made the monthly pilgrimage out to the warehouse to collect my 8 packets of laundry soap powder from the unsmiling inmate in charge of issuing them. Laundry soap days happened once a month. On one appointed weekday, all the evens would troop out to the warehouse during the lunch hour to claim their 8 packets. The next day, the odds would go. The prisoners who worked in the warehouse, a secretive bunch, took this enterprise very seriously. They treated soap days as an invasion of their turf, and would all sit or stand silently while other prisoners lined up to collect the one handout that the prison gave to prisoners. I never understood why laundry soap was the one free thing provided to us, other than our toilet paper rations, which were passed out once a week, and the sanitary napkins and tampons stocked in the bathroom. Laundry soap was sold on commissary. Some women would buy Tide and give away their 8 free soap packets to others who had nothing. Why not soap to clean your body? Why not toothpaste? Somewhere within the monstrous bureaucracy of the Bureau of Prisons, this all made sense to someone. I carefully studied long-timers like Natalie. How had she done it? How had she served 8 years in this rotten place with her grace, her dignity, her sanity intact? What had she drawn on to make it through, with only 9 months until her release to the outside world? The advice I got from many quarters was, do your time, don't let the time do you. Like everyone in prison, I was going to have to learn from the masters. I settled into rituals, which improved the quality of my existence immeasurably. The ritual of coffee making and drinking was one of the first. The day I arrived, a brassy former stockbroker had given me instant coffee in a foil bag and a can of Cremora, Larry, an insufferable coffee snob, was insanely particular about brewing methods, preferring a French press. I wondered what he would do if he was locked up. Would he give up coffee entirely, or adapt to Nescafe? I would make my cup in the morning at the temperamental hot water dispenser and carry it down to the chow hall for breakfast. After our late afternoon dinner, Nina would often appear inquiring whether I wanted to get coffee. I always did. We would mix up our cups and find seats where the weather allowed, sometimes sitting out behind A dorm looking south toward New York. We would talk about Brooklyn, her kids, Larry, and books. We'd gossip about other prisoners. I would ask her endless questions about how to do time. Sometimes Nina wasn't in the mood to get coffee. I'm sure that my tag-along tendencies got old for her, but when I needed her wisdom, she was always there. I tore through every book I received, stayed out of the TV rooms, and watched with envy as people went off to their prison jobs. One could rearrange a footlocker only so many ways. I suspected work would help slaughter time. I tried to figure out who did what, and why some of them got to wear nifty army green jumpsuits. Some prisoners worked in the camp's kitchen. Others, working as orderlies, washed floors and cleaned the bathroom in common areas. The benefit of the orderly jobs was that you worked only a few hours a day, usually alone. A handful of prisoners worked as trainers for seeing eye dogs with whom they lived 24/7, a program tragically known as Puppies Behind Bars. Some women worked in CMS, construction and maintenance services, getting on a bus every morning to do jobs like plumbing and grounds maintenance. An elite crew trooped off to the warehouse, the stopping point for everything that either entered or left the prison, and where the contraband opportunities were rich. Certain prisoners worked in Unicor, the prison industries company that operates within the federal prison system. Unicor manufactures a wide range of products that are then sold within the government for many millions of dollars. In Danbury, the FCI made radio components for the Army. Unicor paid significantly more than other prison jobs, over $1 an hour as opposed to the regular base pay rate of 14 cents an hour. And the Unicor workers were always dressed in pressed, tidy uniforms. Unicor people would disappear into a large warehouse building that always had semis parked outside. Some girls enjoyed silent flirtation with the truckers, who looked nervous but intrigued. Rosemarie had secured herself a job in the puppy program, which was housed in A dorm. That meant she lived with a Labrador retriever that was being trained to be a seeing eye dog or a bomb sniffer. The dogs were beautiful, the little puppies adorable. A warm, squirming lapful of golden puppy, licking and biting and unabashedly happy, made despair dissolve no matter how hard you were hanging on to it. I wasn't eligible for Puppies Behind Bars. My 15-month sentence was too short. Initially disappointed, on reflection I decided it wasn't necessarily a bad thing. The program attracted some of the most obsessive-compulsive women in the camp, and their OCD could really come into full flower as they trained the dogs, forming intense bonds with their canine companions and feuding with their human neighbors. Rosemarie quickly became consumed with the training of her dog, Amber. I didn't mind because she would usually let me play with the puppy, which some of her fellow dog trainers frowned upon. The doyenne of the puppy program was Mrs. Jones, the only person in camp that anyone called Mrs. Mrs. Jones had been in prison for a long time, and it was obvious. A grizzled, steel-haired Irish woman with enormous breasts, she had been down for almost 15 years on a drug sentence. Her husband was said to have beaten her viciously on the outside and to have died in prison. Good riddance to bad rubbish. Mrs. Jones was a little crazy, but most prisoners and guards gave her more leeway than they might extend to others. After 15 years, anyone would have gone a little crazy. People liked to sing a few bars of Me and Mrs. Jones from time to time. Some of the younger women from the street called her the OG, original gangster, and she loved that.
"That's me, the OG. I'm crazy like a fox," she would cackle, tapping her temple.
She seemed to lack any filter and would say exactly what she thought at any time. Although interacting with Mrs. Jones required patience, I liked her, and her candor, too. I wasn't allowed to be a dog trainer, but surely the right job for me was here somewhere. Danbury had a distinct labor hierarchy, and I was at the bottom of it. I wanted to teach in the GED program, which was overseen by a staff teacher and augmented by prisoners who were tutors. The handful of middle-class, educated prisoners with whom I often ate meals warned me against it. Although the program's female staffer was well-liked, they said the combination of a bad program with captive and often surly students made for a crappy work environment. Not a pleasant experience. Clusterfuck. I copped out after a month. It sounded like my friend Ed's job teaching public high school in New York City. Nevertheless, I requested the job, and Mr. Butorsky, who controlled assignments, said that should work out just fine. As it turned out, he was not as good as his word. Chapter 6. High Voltage. One morning, my A&O pal, little Janet, found me and said, "We have jobs." We were assigned to the electric shop, in construction and maintenance services. I was disappointed. What about teaching? Feeding the hungry minds of the downtrodden, which were waiting to break free? The mandatory GED program had been temporarily shut down. The two classrooms had been overrun with a virulent, toxic killer mold that crawled over textbooks, walls, and furniture and made many people sick. The inmate teachers had reportedly sneaked samples of the mold to a sympathetic outsider for analysis and filed a grievance. The staff teacher had sided with the prisoners, to the fury of prison management. The students were gleeful about the shutdown, most of them not wanting to be there in the first place. So, it was voltage for me instead. The next day, little Janet and I followed the other CMS workers out into the March chill, to a big white school bus parked behind the chow hall. After more than a month of being trapped in the confines of the camp, the bus ride was exhilarating. We rode around to the back of the FCI and were deposited amid an assembly of low buildings. These were the CMS shops: garage, plumbing, safety, construction, carpentry, grounds, and electric, each housed in its own building. Janet and I entered the electric shop, blinking in the sudden dimness we found there. The room had a cement floor half filled with chairs, many broken, a desk with a television sitting on it, and blackboards where someone was keeping a large hand-drawn monthly calendar, crossing off the days. There was a refrigerator and a microwave and a feeble-looking potted plant. One alcove was caged off and brightly lit, filled with enough tools to stock a small hardware store. An enclosed office had a door plastered with union stickers. My fellow prisoners grabbed all the functional seats. I sat on the desk next to the TV. The door banged open.
"Good morning."
A tall, bearded man with buggy eyes and a trucker hat strode through to the office. Joyce, who was friendly with Janet, said, "That's Mr. DeSimon." About 10 minutes later, DeSimon emerged from the office and took roll call. He sized up each of us as he read out our names.
"The clerk will explain the tool room rules," he said. "Break the rules, you're going to the SHU.
He went back into the office. We looked at Joyce. "Are we going to do any work?" She shrugged. "Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. It just depends on his mood."
"Kerman!"
I jumped. I looked at Joyce. She widened her eyes at me. "Go in there," she hissed. I cautiously approached the office door.
"Can you read, Kerman?"
"Yes, Mr. DeSimon, I can read."
"Good for you. Read this."
He dropped a primer on his desk.
"And get your convict buddies who are new to read it, too. You'll be tested on it."
I backed out of the office. The packet was a basic course in electrics, power generation,
electrical current, and basic circuitry. I thought for a moment about the safety requirements of the job and looked around at my coworkers with some concern. There were a couple of old hands, like Joyce, who was Filipina and sarcastic as hell. Everyone else was new like me. In addition to little Janet, there was Shirley, an extremely nervous Italian who seemed to think she was going to be shanked at any moment. Yvette, a sweet Puerto Rican who was halfway through a 14-year sentence and yet still had, at most, 17 words of English at her command. And Levy, a tiny French-Moroccan Jew who claimed to have been educated at the Sorbonne. For all her preening about her Sorbonne education, Levy was totally useless at our electrical studies. We spent a couple of weeks studying those primers. Well, some of us did. At which point, we were given a test. Everyone cheated, sharing the answers. I was pretty sure there would be no repercussions to either flunking the test or being caught cheating. It all seemed absurd to me. No one was going to get fired for incompetence. However, simple self-preservation demanded that I read and remember the explanations of how to control electric current without frying myself. This was not how it was all going to end for me, sprawled in polyester khaki on linoleum, with a tool belt strapped to my waist. One snowy day, just a week later, we reported to the electric shop after lunch to find DeSimon jingling the keys to the big white electric shop van.
Kerman, Rialis, Levy, get in the van.
We trundled out and climbed in after him. The van sped down a hill, past a building that housed a daycare for the children of COs, and through a cluster of about a dozen little white government houses where some COs lived. We often spent our workdays changing exterior light bulbs or checking the electric panels in these buildings. But today, DeSimon didn't stop. Instead, he pulled off of prison property and onto the main thoroughfare that skirted the institution. Little Janet and Levy and I looked at each other in astonishment. Where on earth was he taking us? About a quarter mile from the prison grounds, the van pulled up next to a small concrete building in a residential neighborhood. We followed DeSimon up to the building, which he unlocked. A mechanical din came from inside.
"What is this place, Mr. DeSimon?" asked Levy.
"Pump house. Controls water to the facility," he replied.
He looked around the interior and then locked the door again.
"Stay here."
And with that, he climbed into the van and drove away. Little Janet, Levy, and I stood there outside the building with our mouths open. Was I hallucinating? Had he really just left us here in the outside world? Three uniformed prisoners, out and about? Was this some sort of sick test? Little Janet, who before Danbury had been locked up for over 2 years in extremely poor conditions, looked like she was in shock.
Levy was agitated. "What is he thinking? What if people see us? They will know we are prisoners."
"There is no way that this is not against the rules," I said.
"We're gonna get in trouble,"
little Janet wailed. I wondered what would happen if we left. Obviously, we would be in massive trouble and be sent to the SHU and probably catch a new charge for escape. But how long would it take them to nab us?
"Look at these houses. Oh my God, a school bus. I miss my children."
Levy started to cry. I felt terrible for anyone who was separated from her children by prison. But I also knew that Levy's kids lived nearby and that she would not allow them to come visit her because she didn't want them to see her in prison. I thought this was horrible, and that for a kid, the unpleasantness of the prison setting would be more than offset by the eyewitness reassurance that their mother was okay. Anyway, I wanted Levy to stop crying. "Let's look around," I said.
"No!" little Janet practically shouted. "Piper, we are going to get in so much trouble. Don't even move your feet."
She looked so stressed that I acquiesced. We stood there like idiots. Nothing was happening. The suburban neighborhood was quiet. Every couple of minutes a car would drive by. No one pointed or screeched to a halt at the sight of three convicts off the plantation. Eventually, a man walked by with an enormous shaggy dog. I perked up. I can't tell if that's a Newfoundland or a Great Pyrenees. Good-looking dog, huh? I can't believe you. You're looking at the dog? Said little Janet. The man was looking at us.
He sees us?
Of course he sees us, Levy. We're three female inmates standing on a street corner. How's he going to miss us? The man raised his hand and waved cheerfully as he passed. After about 45 minutes, DeSimon returned with brooms and set us to work cleaning the pump house. The next week, we were made to clean out the root cellar, a long, low barn on the prison grounds. The root cellar contained a hodgepodge of equipment from all the shops. In the dark shadows, we discovered enormous snake skins that had been shed, which freaked us out and made DeSimon cackle with glee. An outside inspection was coming soon, and the prison staff wanted to be ready. There was actual trash to be removed from the root cellar, a dirty and often heavy job, and we spent days hauling huge metal pipes, stockpiles of hardware, fixtures, and components out to the giant dumpsters. Into the dumpster went ceramic bathtubs and sinks still in their boxes, new baseboard heating components, and unopened 50-pound boxes of nails. "Your family's tax dollars at work," we muttered under our breath. I had never worked so physically hard in my life. By the time we were finished, the root cellar was empty, spotless, and tidy for inspection. While I was quickly learning that even in prison, rules were made to be broken by staff and prisoners alike, there was one aspect of work in the electric shop that was meticulously observed and enforced. A large cage of tools, where the shop clerk sat, contained everything from bandsaws to hilti drills to myriad types of special screwdrivers, pliers, wire cutters, and individual tool belts loaded with complete sets of the basics. A whole room filled with potentially murderous objects. There was a system for checking out those tools. Each prisoner had an assigned number and a bunch of corresponding metal chits that looked like dog tags. When we went out to do a job, each prisoner signed out a tool with a chit and was responsible for returning it. At the end of each shift, DeSimon would inspect the tool cage. He made it clear that if a tool went missing, the prisoner whose chit occupied the empty space and the shop clerk were both going to the SHU. It was the only rule that appeared to matter to him. One day, a drill bit went missing, and we tore the shop and the truck apart looking for it while he watched, the clerk on the edge of tears, until finally we found the twisted piece of metal rolling around in the lid of one of the toolboxes. DeSimon was relentlessly unpleasant to many of the prison staff as well, who called him Swamp Yankee, and worse. He may have been widely disliked, but he was also the head of the institution's union chapter, which meant that management let him do as he pleased. "DeSimon's a prick," one of the other shop heads told me candidly. "That's why we elected him." Under the prick's indifferent tutelage, I learned the rudimentary basics of electric work. A group of totally inexperienced women working with high voltage and nearly no supervision did yield moments of broad comedy and only occasional bodily injury. In addition to a butch tool belt, prison work gave me a greater sense of normalcy, another way of marking time, and people with whom I had something in common. Best of all, I was sent over to the garage to obtain my prison driving license, which allowed me to drive the CMS vehicles. Although I loathed DeSimon, I was glad to be kept semi-busy 5 days a week and ecstatic at the freedom of movement I had driving the electric shop van around the prison grounds. On a Friday, when we returned from work to the camp, Big Boo Clemens from B Dorm came out to meet the CMS bus. "Guilty on all four counts," she reported with great excitement. Inside, we found the TV rooms packed, because a jury had found Martha Stewart guilty on 4 counts of obstructing justice and lying to investigators about a well-timed stock sale. The styled diva was going to have to do Fed time. Her case had been followed with keen interest at Danbury. Most prisoners thought she was being targeted because she was a famous female. Guys get away with that shit all the time. One afternoon, Levy, our nervous co-worker Shirley, and I, geared up in our tool belts, were shuttling around the staff housing on the grounds, checking the circuit panels in every house. DeSimon escorted us from house to house, where he would make small talk with the occupants while we did our thing. It was bizarre to go into the homes of our jailers and see their angel collections and family photos and pets and laundry and messy basements.
"They have no class," sneered Levy.
I didn't like prison guards, but she was insufferable. When we got back to the shop, DeSimon left, and it was up to us to clean out the truck and return the tools to the cage. That's when I discovered the extra screwdriver in my belt. "Levy, Shirley, I've got one of your screwdrivers." They both checked their belts. No, they had theirs. I held two screwdrivers in my hands, confused. "But if you've got yours, then where?" I was mystified. "I must have picked this one up in one of the houses?" My eyes met Levy and nervous Shirley's, which were huge.
"What are you going to do?"
Shirley hissed. My stomach dropped. I started to sweat. I saw myself in the SHU, with no visits from Larry, with another criminal charge for stealing a CO's potentially deadly screwdriver. And I had these two fools in on the game, no one's choice for accomplices.
"I don't know what I'm going to do, but you don't know a thing about this, understand?"
I hissed back. They hurried into the shop and I stood outside, looking around wildly. What the fuck was I going to do with this screwdriver? I was terrified because I knew it could be construed as a weapon. How could I get rid of it? If I found a hiding place, what if someone found it? How did you destroy a screwdriver? My eyes fixed on the CMS dumpster. It was big, and all the shops threw their garbage, all kinds of garbage, in there. It got emptied often, and the garbage was taken away, to Mars as far as I was concerned. I grabbed the shop garbage and strode toward the dumpster. I fiddled with the garbage bag while I surreptitiously wiped the screwdriver like a maniac, trying to get rid of fingerprints. Then, I flung both into the dumpster, which unfortunately didn't sound very full. It was done. Heart pounding, I returned to the shop and put away my tool belt. I didn't even look at nervous Shirley or Levy. That night, I went over the screwdriver problem again and again in my mind. What if the CO noticed it was missing and remembered that inmates had been in his house? He would raise the alarm, and then what? An investigation, interrogations, and then Levy and nervous Shirley would give me up in a hot second. I closed my eyes. I was dead. The next morning at the shop, an eerie air raid siren went off. I almost vomited. Shirley looked faint. Levy appeared completely unconcerned. Usually, the siren was used for recalls, sending us back to our housing units for either emergency or special practice counts. But this time, nothing happened. The alarm went off for many excruciating minutes until it stopped. Shirley went outside to smoke a cigarette with trembling hands. At lunch, I found Nina and told her what had happened, deeply rattled. She rolled her eyes. "Jesus Christ, Piper. Let's go look for it after lunch. You'll just give it to DeSimon and explain. They ain't gonna lock you up." But the dumpster was empty. Nina frowned and looked at me. I wanted to cry.
"Nina, you don't think the siren this morning?"
Although she was concerned, this struck her as hilarious. "No, Piper, I don't think the siren this morning was for you. I think the garbage is gone, and the screwdriver's gone, and if the evidence is gone, then they can't prove shit. Most likely, nothing at all's gonna happen. And if it does, it's your word against Levy or Shirley, and let's face it, they're wackos. Who's gonna believe them?" One afternoon, I returned to B dorm to find my neighbor Colleen in a state of great excitement.
"My girls Jay and Bobby just got here from Brooklyn,"
Pipesta, you got any extra toothpaste I can give them or any other stuff?
Colleen explained that before she'd been designated to Danbury, she had spent time with her two friends in the Brooklyn Metropolitan Correctional Center, also known as a federal jail. Now her pals had just arrived off the transport bus.
They're both real cool, Piper. You'll like them.
On my way to the gym, I saw a black woman and a white woman standing out behind the camp building in the early spring drizzle, staring up at the clouds. I didn't recognize them. I decided they must be Colleen's friends.
Hey, I'm Piper. Are you guys Colleen's friends?
I live next to her. Let me know if you need anything. They lowered their faces from the sky and looked at me. The black woman was about 30, pretty and solidly built with high cheekbones. She looked like she'd been carved out of super smooth wood. The white woman was smaller and older, maybe 45, and had coarse skin like a coral reef and eyes with as many shades of blue as the ocean. Right now, they looked aquamarine.
Thanks, she said. I'm Bobby. This is Jay. You got any cigarettes?
Her heavy New York accent suggested many late nights and many cigarettes.
Hi, Jay. No, sorry, I don't smoke. I've got toiletries, though, if you need.
I was getting wet and it was cold.
Still, I was curious about these two.
Kind of crap weather out here.
At this, they looked at each other.
We ain't felt the rain for 2 years, said Jay, the black woman.
What?
In Brooklyn, there's a little rec deck to take us up on, but it's covered over, barbed wire and shit, and you don't really see the sky, she explained. So we don't mind the rain. We love it.
And she put her head back again, face up, as close to the sky as it could get. In the electric shop, things were changing. Vera, the woman with the most experience, left to go to the only women's boot camp program in Texas. Boot camp, an early release program that has since been eliminated, was 6 hard months in the Texas heat, where rumor had it that you were housed in a giant tent and required to shave your pubic hair to make insect detection easier. Vera's departure to Texas meant that the leadership in the electric shop shifted to Joyce. Joyce was a reasonably confident replacement, having learned from Vera how to do the electric work that was required on a frequent or daily basis, changing 8-foot-long fluorescents, replacing the ballasts of light fixtures, installing new exit signs and fixtures, and checking circuit boards. Levy soon became the unifying factor in the shop. The rest of us united against her. She was insufferable, crying daily and complaining loudly and constantly about her measly 6-month sentence, asking inappropriate personal questions, trying to boss people around, and making appalling and loud statements about other prisoners' appearance and lack of education, sophistication, or class, as she put it. More than once, campers had to be talked out of kicking her ass, which was done by reminding them that she was not worth the trip to the SHU. Most of the time, she was nervous, verging on hysterical, which manifested in dramatic physical symptoms. An astonishing hive-like swelling made her look like the Elephant Man, and her always sweating hands made her particularly useless for working with electricity. DeSimon kept a television in the shop. He would periodically emerge from his office, toss a VHS tape at us, and grunt, "Watch this," then leave us for hours. These instructional videos explained the rudiments of electrical current and also very basic wiring procedures. While uninterested in the content of the videos, my coworkers quickly figured out how to rig up the TV with an illegal makeshift antenna. That way, we could watch Jerry Springer. One con would man the lookout post by the window to spot any approaching COs. I was trying to learn some Spanish, and my coworker Yvette was very patiently trying to teach me, but what I managed to pick up was almost exclusively about food, sex, or curses. Yvette was by far the most competent of my coworkers, and she and I would often work together on any electrical job requiring proficiency with tools.
This occasioned conversations where every sentence suffered from multiple fractures, coupled with a lot of cautious mime. Neither of us wanted to get shocked. I had already learned the hard way what that was like. Your head snaps back as if you've been kicked under the chin. Jay, my neighbor Colleen's pal, was assigned to the electric shop. She had been cleared to work back in the Brooklyn MCC, so her paperwork didn't take long. She got the clerk job.
As long as I don't have to touch wires and shit, I'm cool, she said.
By default, she hung out with me at work. I was best buddies with Little Janet, and Little Janet was the only other black person in electric. As the New England spring took its sweet time arriving, the three of us occupied the bench in front of the shop, smoking and watching the comings and goings of other prisoners. The guards went in and out of their deluxe gym, which was located directly across from the electric building. There were long stretches of inactivity during which we shot the shit, about the drug game, distant memories for me, about New York City, where we all were from, about men, about life. Little Janet could hold her own with us, despite being 15 years younger, and I could hold my own with them, despite being white. Little Janet was excitable, eager to argue a point or show off a dance move or just act silly, while Jay was funny and mellow, with an easy laugh. She had served just 2 years of a 10-year sentence, but she never seemed bitter, just measured and mindful. But she had a quiet sadness about her, and a deep, still quality that seemed to be the part of her that she would not allow her surroundings and circumstances to destroy. When she talked about her sons, a teenager and an 8-year-old, her face shone. I admired the humor and calm with which she handled her losses and our prison world. Her dignity was not as quiet as Natalie's, but was just as lovely. Joyce, from the electric shop, was going home soon. She had drawn the calendar on the blackboard in the shop and would cross off every day that passed with chalk. About a week before she was due for release, she asked if I would color her hair. I must have shown my surprise at the intimate request. "You're the only one I know who seems like they won't fuck it up," she explained in her sharp, matter-of-fact way. We went into the salon room off the camp's main hallway, a space that occupied as much room as the law library, about the size of a large closet. There were 2 old pink hair sinks with nozzles for rinsing, a couple of salon chairs in almost total disrepair, and some standing dryers that looked like they were from the early 1960s. Shears and other cutting instruments were kept in a locked cage mounted on the wall. Only the CO could unlock it. One of the chairs was occupied by a woman having her hair set by a friend. As I worked on the sections of Joyce's straight, shiny hair, carefully following the directions on the box, I felt proud that she had asked me. But I also felt a bit more like a normal girl, performing beauty chores with girlfriends. When I accidentally sent the sink nozzle shooting out of control, spraying water everywhere, to my surprise, everyone laughed instead of cursing me out. Maybe, just a little, I was starting to fit in. In the free world, your residence can be a peaceful retreat from a long day at work. In prison, not so much. A loud discussion of farting was happening in B dorm. It had been initiated by Asia, who didn't actually live in B and was chased out. "Asia, you're out of bounds. Get your grimy ass out of here, you project hoe," someone bawled after her. I was surviving just fine in the ghetto of B dorm, due to my luck in having been paired with Natalie, and maybe to my stubborn conviction that I would be acting like a racist baby if I tried to get moved, and perhaps also to the fact that I had gone to an elite women's college. Single-sex living has certain constants, whether it's upscale or down and dirty. At Smith College, the pervasive obsession with food was expressed at candlelight dinners and at Friday afternoon faculty teas. In Danbury, it was via microwave cooking and stolen food. In many ways, I was more prepared to live in close quarters with a bunch of women than some of my fellow prisoners, who were driven crazy by communal female living. There was less bulimia and more fights than I had known as an undergrad, but the same feminine ethos was present. Empathetic camaraderie and body humor on good days, and histrionic dramas coupled with meddling malicious gossip on bad days. It was a weird place, the all-female society with a handful of strange men, the military-style living, the predominant ghetto vibe, both urban and rural. Through a female lens, the mix of every age, from silly young girls to old grandmas, all thrown together with varying levels of tolerance. Crazy concentrations of people inspire crazy behavior. I can just now step back far enough to appreciate its surreal singularity. But to be back with Larry in New York, I would have walked across broken glass barefoot in a snowstorm all the way home. Mr. Butorsky, my counselor, had a policy he had come up with all by himself. Once a week, he would put every prisoner he supervised, half the camp, on the call out for a 1-minute appointment with him. He had to report to the office he shared with Torricella and sign a big logbook to acknowledge you had been there. "Anything going on?" he would ask. That was your chance to ask questions, spill your guts, or complain. I only asked questions, usually to have a visitor approved. Sometimes he was feeling curious. "How are you doing, Kerman?" I was fine. "Everything going all right with Miss Malcolm?" "Yes, she was great." "She's a nice lady. Never gives me any problems. Not like some of her kind."
Mr. Butorsky.
"It's a big adjustment for someone like you, Kerman. But you seem to be handling it."
"Is there anything else, Mr. Butorsky? 'Cause if not, I'm going to go..."
Or chatty. "I'm almost done here, Kerman. Almost 20 years I've been at this. Things have changed. People at the top have different ideas about how to do things. Of course, they have no idea what really goes on here with these people."
"Well, Mr. Butorsky, I'm sure you'll enjoy retirement."
"Yeah, I'm thinking of someplace like Wisconsin, where there's more of us northerners, if you know what I mean."
Minetta, the town driver who had brought me up to camp on my first day, was due to be released in April. As her date was nearing, the line of succession was the hot topic around camp, as the town driver was the one prisoner who was allowed off the plantation on a daily basis. She was responsible for doing errands for the prison staff in town, ferrying inmates and their CO escorts to hospital appointments, and driving prisoners to the bus station after they had been released, plus any other mission that was handed to her. Never, ever had a town driver been chosen who was not a northerner. One day, I went into the counselor's office for my call-out minute. As I was signing the book, Mr. Butorsky stared at me.
"Kerman, how about applying for the town driver position? Minetta is leaving soon. We need someone responsible for that job. It's an important job."
Let me think about it, Mr. Butorsky."
"Sure, Kerman. You go right ahead and think about it."
On the one hand, being the town driver would mean the opportunity to rendezvous with Larry in gas station bathrooms and the outside world. On the other hand, the town driver was widely held to be the designated camp snitch. I was no snitch, no way. And clearly, no good could come from coziness with prison staff, which the town driver position required. The uncomfortable privilege and collaborator subtext was more than I could stomach. Plus, after my screwdriver misadventure, I didn't have the stomach for illicit activities, even assignations, no matter how much I lusted for Larry. The next week in Butorsky's office, I quietly turned the job down, much to his surprise. When I first arrived at the camp, Pop, the ruler of the kitchen, would watch the prison-screened movie of the week flanked by Minetta and Nina, Pop's bunkie. They would sit in a prime spot in the back of the room and kibitz and enjoy contraband delicacies, courtesy of Pop. When Minetta left for the halfway house, her movie seat was briefly taken by a tall, imposing, and largely silent white girl who was a prolific crocheter and was also leaving soon.
Nina was also preparing to depart, but she was going down the hill to a 9-month residential drug program. It was for prisoners with documented drug and alcohol addictions, who had been fortunate enough to be flagged for the program by their sentencing judge. It was the only serious rehabilitative program at Danbury, other than the puppies, and it is currently the only way in the federal system to significantly reduce your sentence. Campers headed to the drug program were always scared, as it took place not in the camp, but in the real prison. High security, locked down, and 1,200 women serving serious time, some with life sentences. Nina had the added concern of finding an acceptable replacement for herself at Pop's side. After my initial faux pas in the dining room, it didn't even occur to me that I was a candidate. But one Saturday night in the common room, Nina beckoned to me. She and the quiet girl were sitting with Pop. "Pipa, come have some food." Contraband food was irresistible. One did not readily pass up the simple novelty of eating something other than institutional food, cooked with a measure of love. I was pretty damn shy, though, after Pop's veiled threat in the chow hall. They had guacamole and chips. I knew the avocados had been purchased from the commissary and were not really contraband. I took a little bite, but didn't want to seem greedy. "It's so good, thank you." Pop was looking at me sidelong. "Go on, have some more," Nina said. "I'm okay, I'm kind of full, but thank you." I started to edge away. "Come on, Piper, sit down for a minute." Now I was nervous, but I trusted Nina. I pulled up an extra chair and perched on it, ready to flee at any sign of Pop's displeasure. I made small talk about the other woman's imminent return to the outside world. How great it would be for her to be reunited with her teenage son, and whether she would find work with the Carpenters Union. When the movie started, I excused myself. They made the same advance the next week. That night they offered me burgers, fat and juicy compared to the ones in the dining hall. I wolfed one down without prodding, tasting oregano and thyme. Pop seemed entertained by my relish and leaned over to confide, "I use extra spices." A day or two later, Nina posed a question to me. "What do you think about watching the movie with Pop when I go to the drug program?" she asked.
"What?"
"She needs someone to keep her company when I leave and get her ice and soda for her, you know?"
Did Pop really want my company?
"Well, you're not a wacko, you know? That's why we're friends, 'cause I can really talk to you about things." The invitation seemed like the ultimate endorsement, and not one to be turned down lightly. When I saw Pop, I tried to be charming, and perhaps I was somewhat successful. The non-wacko contingent must have been thin on the ground at that time in the camp, because a week or so later, Nina asked me if I wanted to take her place as Pop's bunkie in A dorm, the suburbs. I was perplexed. "But I'm already in B dorm. I can't move." Nina rolled her eyes. "Piper, Pop gets whatever bunkie she wants." I was stunned by this revelation that a prisoner could get what she wanted. Of course, if that inmate is the prime reason that your institutional kitchen runs in an orderly fashion,
"You mean they'll move me?"
More eye rolling. I frowned, lost between contradictory impulses. B dorm was certainly living up to its ghetto moniker, with all the irritants of any ghetto. One B dorm practice alone drove me to the tooth-grinding brink of sanity. People would hang their little headphones on the metal bunks and blast their pocket radios through the makeshift speakers, foisting their staticky music on everyone at top tinny volume. It wasn't the music I objected to, it was the terrible audio quality. But A dorm seemed populated by a disproportionate number of fussy old ladies, plus the puppy program dogs and their people, who were mostly nuts. And I didn't want anyone to think I was a racist, although nobody else in the camp seemed to have the slightest compunction about expressing the broadest racial generalizations. "Honey," another prisoner drawled to me, "everyone here is just trying to live up to the worst cultural stereotype possible."
In fact, that was part of the motivation of this new invitation.
Pop don't want any lesbians in there, said matter-of-fact Nina. And you're a nice white girl.
On the one hand, Pop would certainly be an advantageous monkey, as she clearly wielded a lot of influence in the camp. On the other hand, I had a strong suspicion that she would be a high-maintenance cube mate. Look at the hustle Nina was putting on for her. Finally, I thought about Natalie. How kind she had been to me, and how easy she was to live with. And she was just 9 months from going home. If I bailed on her, who knew what kind of kook they would stick in Cube 18?
Nina, I don't think I can just ditch Miss Natalie, I said. She has been really good to me.
I hope Pop understands.
Nina looked surprised.
Well, help me think about who else we can get.
What about Tony? She's Italian.
I said that sounded grand. They would be a perfect fit. And retreated to B-dorm, my ghetto home. Chapter 7. The Hours. There were a host of religious opportunities at Danbury. A Friday Mass for Catholics, and sometimes a Sunday Mass as well, usually delivered by the hot priest, a young padre who played guitar and spoke Italian and was thus adored by all the Italian Americans. A Spanish Christian service on the weekends, a Buddhist meditation group, and also rabbinical visits on Wednesdays. And a wacky weekly non-denominational be-in led by volunteers armed with acoustic guitars and scented candles. The biggie, though, was the Christian, aka fundamentalist, service held in the visiting room on Sunday evenings after visiting hours were over. In March, I asked Sister Rafferty, the German nun who was the head chaplain, whether there would be any provision for Episcopalians on Easter Sunday. She looked at me as if I had three heads, then replied that if I wanted to hunt down my own minister and put him or her on my full visitors list, then we could use the chapel. Thanks for nothing, sister. I found the religious prostrations of my saber-rattling born-again neighbors tedious. Some of the faithful had a distinct aspect of roostering, loudly proclaiming that they were going to pray on any number of topics. How God was walking beside them through their incarceration, how Jesus loved sinners, and so on. Personally, I thought that one could thank the Lord at a lower volume, and perhaps with less self-congratulation. You could worship loudly and still act pretty lousy, abundant evidence of which was running around the dorms. There were no new spring hats or dresses in prison, but the week before Easter, someone erected a creepy giant wooden cross behind the camp, right outside the dining hall. I was confronted with it at breakfast and could only ask, "What the fuck?" of Mrs. Jones, the gruff old queen of the puppy program and one of the old ladies who always came to breakfast. I was surprised to learn that she was only 55. Prison will age a gal prematurely.
"They always put it up," she reported. "Some clown from CMS came up and did it."
A few days later, Nina and I were discussing the impending holidays over a cup of instant coffee. Levy and the one other Jew in residence, the decidedly more likable Gail Greenman, had been given boxes of matzah by the German nun for Passover. This excited the interest of the other prisoners.
"How come they get them big crackers?"
a neighbor from B dorm asked me, probing the mysteries of faith.
"Them crackers would be good with jelly."
Nina, her bangs in rollers, tilted her head as she reminisced about Passover's past. "One year I was in Rikers. Matzah was the only edible thing they gave us," she mused, rolling her cigarette thoughtfully between her fingers. "It's delicious with butter." This year, I would not be ferrying back and forth between Larry's family Seder and my own Easter traditions. Too bad. I love the 10 plagues. Pop and her crew pulled out all the stops for Easter dinner. It was positively lavish, a spring miracle. The menu? Baked chicken and cabbage with astonishing dumplings, so dense you could have used them as weapons. Mustardy deviled eggs
and real vegetables on the salad bar. For dessert, we had Natalie's very special bird's nest confection, a deep-fried tortilla cupping a mound of pudding covered with lush green-dyed coconut grass strewn with jelly bean eggs and a gaily colored marshmallow peep perched on top. I just stared at it, unable to believe my eyes, while everyone around me ate enthusiastically. I didn't want to eat this incredible diorama. I wanted to shellac it and save it forever. Right after Easter, Nina left to go down the hill to the high-security prison for the drug program. I would miss her. She had been knitting a scarf for weeks and weeks, and I had been consulting on it. "What color do you think now?" she would say, pulling out a remarkable collection of little scraps of yarn she had scavenged. "Purple," I would point. "Green." The whole camp was in the process of readying the 8 women who were entering the strict 9-month drug program. This process included purging any contraband they might have, acquiring new stuff at commissary,